figure out whether or not there's an error in the final results that we're showing for the title board action on number 126 previously. And we've listened to the record, and the results that we reported are incorrect. And I first would like to correct that, get that on the record. And we did listen to almost the entire hearing, and also the final results were read into the record at the last meeting. So I think we can fix that up on the results that are shown on the screen, which is what Ms. Gomez is trying to do. What we heard was there were first the changes that are reflected there. There was a change to the staff draft. Instead of saying to provide just compensation as the original staff draft provided, the board adopted a change that just said simply to compensate an owner. And that was already correctly reflected in the results reported. But the draft submitted by the proponents, that with the changes that Ms. Gomez is showing, those were also adopted as well. We did adopt that comma.
Oh, we did. Okay.
Yeah. And there were a couple of variations. There were a couple of commas inserted in the proponent's draft in that last clause that begins unless said land use regulations serve. That's the clause that was omitted from the results reported by my office, but that was adopted. But there was a comma inserted between more and unless. That was different from what Mr. Detsky proposed last time. And then there was a comma also inserted in right after values, commonly held community values, comma, or protect the built or natural environment. That comma was also added by the board. What Ms. Gomez is now edited into the final results previously shown, I think, is the correct results adopted by the board last time. And I don't think we need a motion for that. I think I'm simply reflecting, having listened to the record now, that what is shown is what was adopted by the board. Any discussion? I'm planning to then just move on to the motion for rehearing, unless there's some question or objection. Mr. Gressler.
I just have my piece of paper back that I handed out. Thank you.
A modest request. I'm sorry. That whole explanation, since you didn't have your copy handy.
That reflects, I think that pretty much reflects exactly what the proponents had submitted to the title board. That's what my note.
Okay, and I apologize for the confusion. I think what happened was I when we were considering this before, I failed to ask Ms. Gomez to type those changes into that version. She had already included what we had adopted, but not what was proposed by the proponent. So hope we're back on track. Back to the motion for rehearing. And you might need to straighten this out just a little bit, Mr. Gessler. I know you still have objections, but now that we've at least gotten the correct version before us, you could get us back on track.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My objections were based on this particular mm-hmm. version, the one that's currently on the screen and has been adopted by the title board. That served as the basis for my objections. And I just wanted to point out that two, I believe it's C and D, were somewhat nonsensical based on the published version. But my entire motion for rehearing applies to this particular version.
One of the things, let me ask you about this, and again, I'm still trying to figure out where we are in my own mind. One of the questions that came up last time, and I just want to go back over this again, was the similarity of titles. Now, now that we know what the title board actually adopted last time, there is more difference between the titles than we were reflecting. And I guess the it sounds to me like the major substantive difference between 86 and 126 is 2B, as I recall. And there's also a change in the burden of proof as well. But I think that change that since number 126 adds that new paragraph B, 2B, and the last clause of what the title board added reflects that, there is a difference between this title for 126 and the title set for 86. And I don't know whether that still represents confusion between the two titles.
I still argue that it does represent confusion. And I distinctly remember Mr. Kneiser advising the board that it was probably sufficiently dissimilar to meet standards. We respectfully disagree, and in part not only the failure that it should highlight additional differences, but also the way it's actually structured. In reading that, it isn't until the sixth line of text that a voter begins to identify any meaningful differences between number 86. And there's probably a high likelihood that these won't be immediately adjacent to one another on the ballot either. And I think that the vast majority of voters would look at this and say, I've seen this before. I'll vote the same way as I did before. Because it's so far at the bottom, because it's structured pretty much identically. I think, without our, take basically our discussions, press them into seconds of reading through this in a poll booth while there's a line behind you. And you got to go pick up your kids from work, or you got to get to work. In other words, that's the context in which this stuff is read. And because the structure is so identical and the differences don't appear until the very end, that it's that it remains confusing. And just to highlight a few of the other differences, 2A, 2B, on the first page, sort of second, third block of type from the bottom where it says protect public health, safety, morals, or welfare, it adds those differences. All of 2B the other ones are on the clear and convincing standard, third to the last sheet. The very bottom of that same sheet, they all are construed to protect public health, safety, morals, general welfare. And then, going back to the first page again, 2A1B. Says prior to the acquisition of the property by the owner or a family member of the owner. Our family member. I think those are all meaningful substantive differences that in effect create a much, much different result than the other initiative number 86. And that's of course once we get past the single subject.
Questions from Mr. Gessler? Mr. Dunn, go ahead.
Mr. Gessler, do you think this provision, the measure as drafted, and you cited the English only, or if that's the right name of that case, the practical implication issue in that case. Do you think beyond sort of representing technically what the measure does, as I remember reading that case, the court actually said the title needed to reflect that it would all but eliminate bilingual education. Anybody wants to confirm that analysis?
I think that's the identical analysis. I think that's the exact analysis they used in the English only. I mean, the standard was that, you know, that after reading through it, the court concluded that nevertheless the procedural hurdles and the exceptions for the parental waiver tended to overwhelm and obscure the inevitable outcome of the waiver process when all of the provisions are properly taken into account, and then that required the board to say that.
Did the court set a new title, or did they remand it?
The court remanded it. I don't think the court actually set a new title. I think the court ordered action not inconsistent with their opinion.
So do you think this title needs to reflect sort of just a laundry list of what the measure does, or do you think it needs to actually state that ramification as it relates to the exemptions?
Just give me one moment. I think it requires the title board to actually state the ramifications. Just give me a moment to take a look at the language from the English only.
And I'd be interested in hearing from the proponents, actually. Sorry.
Mr. Neider.
Yes, perhaps I can answer that question. The court in the English immersion case was concerned because we as the title board did list all of the requirements to get a waiver to participate in the bilingual education program. And the court said that the listing of those, of all of the requirements, actually obfuscated the true intent of the measure. And what they asked us to do was to take all of those exceptions and summarize them. Eventually, we did summarize them in a measure that was not appealed to the Supreme Court. And I forget the exact terminology that we used, but it was something along the lines of very restrictive limits on obtaining waivers. That title actually eventually made it to the ballot with that type of language in there. So I'm not saying that necessarily needs to be done in this case, but the court said that the listing of the exceptions sometimes isn't as informative as a summarization of what those exceptions may do.
I mean, and I think what the titles finally said was, I mean, it authorized waivers, but the title said the waivers would be very difficult to obtain. I mean, which was a conclusion that basically the court came to, and I think we had in effect adopted the language from the court's decision.
In that decision, you know, the court used terms like very restrictive, and we basically adopted the language from the court decision and eventually put it in the title that was on the ballot.
My concern is that if, and I'd like to hear the proponent's thought on it, but my concern is that if the 2B list is going to make the actual providing of just compensation almost impossible. And that's an if, but if that is the effect of it, that perhaps the title needs to reflect somehow that's the practical implication of it. So,
and maybe following, I mean, I'm trying to figure out practically if that's correct what we do to the titles, but where that I think points me is to several changes that we might need to make to the titles adopted by the board. Early on, we may need to say, instead of, for example, referring to requiring public entities in certain circumstances, it may need to be requiring public entities in very limited and specific circumstances to compensate an owner. But maybe more to the point, instead of listing the exceptions, in the unless clause or any other exceptions, we would say, but, you know, providing exceptions that effectively mean it would be unusual for there to be compensation or something like that. I mean, that's that conclusion of the effect of the measure was what was happening, I think, with the English language immersion case. And I think that's kind of what I'm concluding. We'd need to do something like that here instead of listing those exceptions. But again, like Mr. Dunn says, I want to hear from the proponents too. But any other questions for Mr. Gessler?
I do have some questions on the single subject.
Well, I was wondering if we were just skipping over that or.
Mr. Dunn.
The Hillside case really just said that a mere procedure doesn't vest a person with a due process right. Correct?
I think the analysis was a little bit more complex than that. Procedure does vest someone with a due process right. Procedural due process, for example. But in order to be able to invoke that procedure, you have to have a property interest.
I'm sorry, yeah, I probably said that incorrectly. A procedure does not in itself vest someone with a property interest.
Correct. Right. You have to have the property interest first based on an analysis of state law. Colorado analyzed state law and said no property interest in land use regulation. In land use regulations, you don't have a property interest in what land use regulations do to your neighbor. This reverses that. Creates that property interest. So maybe I shouldn't say it reverses entirely. No, I guess it does reverse the power of the Supreme Court. It certainly fundamentally changes substantive Colorado law with respect to rights. Those procedures.
Well, in my opinion, I'd actually go with what you first said. That I don't think it reverses. I think it, at most, grants a property right, but I'm not sure it even does that. But I don't see it as reversing the opinion itself. Not that it's obviously a constitutional measure. So I mean, there wouldn't be anything wrong with doing that anyway. But my other question is, can't that be viewed as really just a ramification of the measure that someone then has the right that's created by the measure as a result of their ability to get an exemption, if I've got that right?
I think
rather than creating a right, it's more just an effect.
I don't want to put words in the proponent's mouth, but I would guess that they'd say, yeah, it's just a ramification. But I mean, the ramification is you're a neighboring property owner. You now have a right to intervene because you have a property interest that's protected by that. So it may be couched as a ramification linguistically. In fact, it creates a substantive right.
And how is that a separate and distinct purpose? Tell me about the surprise. I'm trying to figure out what the usual standards. How is this a hidden, separate, surreptitious purpose? Or you apply some of the standards for me here. Because to me it seems related. It seems I can see it's distinct maybe, but it seems to me properly related to the major purpose of the measure. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but.
Obviously, I'm arguing that you are wrong, and I guess the reason why is because the stated purpose of the measure is concerning a requirement that public entities provide remedies to owners of privately owned real property for land use regulations. So that's the enunciated single subject currently. Okay. This is, I'd argue, the exact opposite of providing a remedy to an owner of privately owned real property for land use regulations. Value of that owner's property. Rather, it now applies it. The reverse side of that is it allows a neighboring owner to say, you can't get regulation. Mm-hmm. You can't get compensation for a diminution of value if it affects me. I now have a property interest inhibiting you from getting your remedy. So it's actually it's a separate purpose. I mean, it would be articulated if it were part of a single subject, but that subject would be something along the lines of concerning requirement that private landowners may enforce land use regulations on neighboring properties that diminish that landowner's or that affect that landowner's fair market value. Something along those lines.
But the way I'm seeing this, I think it's quite a bit different. I'm seeing this as kind of a garden variety proposal in with respect to this, that there's a major purpose, a general proposition that's established by the measure, and then there's exceptions. There's exceptions or limitations. There's a general proposition of compensation or exemption, and there's an exception. And that seems to be connected. The fact that all exceptions, all limitations, are the opposite of the major proposition, but they are related. And this one seems to be just one of the exceptions, a major exception or a major limitation. But why can't the proponents limit the very rights that they're granting in their measure under certain circumstances?
Well, I think there's a difference between limiting the right that they've granted in the measure as opposed to granting a right to a neighboring property. I mean, it grants a new right, unrecognized in Colorado law to this date, to a new party. I mean, I guess that's the concern. Yes, can draft anything to be an exception to something else. I mean, sort of structurally and linguistically, which I guess is sort of my response to Mr. Dunn's comment as well. But this particular exception here creates a new right to a party that, you know, has never obtained these rights before. That becomes a different subject, a different matter. Changes the way Colorado law has been interpreted in the past in a way that is not connected with the private remedies to owners of privately owned real property. I mean, perhaps the board could envision a subject that includes both of those types of activities, in which case the single subject would be something different than, you know, providing, you know, compensation for the land use regulation of that property. One can always argue, I guess, that, well, yeah, it affects property regulations. Let's expand the subject as broadly as possible to include that. But here, the fact that it creates this new right, it's hidden. It would create surprise to voters to learn that all of a sudden their neighbors now have a right to enforce regulations against them. I mean, that's sort of the essence of surprise. And I don't think any owner would anticipate, any person who reads this would anticipate that under the subject of I have a right to prevent property from being diminished means all of a sudden now my neighbor has a right to enforce land use regulations against me.
Well, let me take one more run at it, maybe, because I'm not quite clear yet that I'm understanding the measure properly, and that's really important to me. But this seems to be a very logical and connected thing to me, so I'll take another run at it. The general proposition being that governments have to compensate or exempt landowners who are adversely affected by land use regulations. Apart from whether that's good or bad, that I can see that point of view, that somebody who's adversely affected by the land, if their land is adversely affected by land use regulations, there should be compensation or exemption. The problem is, what about, that may be well and good, and I'm trying to articulate this on behalf of the proponents, that may be well and good for the landowner who's adversely affected by that land use regulation, but what if exempting that owner ends up causing an adverse impact to the surrounding property? Doesn't that person necessarily need or want an opportunity to say, what about me? I am about to be adversely affected by this exemption. And isn't it perfectly logical for the proponents to deal with that, Isn't that what the measure does?
As currently structured, I'd argue that's a different subject. I mean, and here's where I step back. Maybe the board would want to create a new single subject in its search for single subjectedness, but that next step, you know, well, what about me? The what about me is something that's never been recognized in Colorado law before.
But it didn't need to be, maybe, without this measure. I mean, this measure creates the need because now surrounding property owners would be adversely affected by what this measure grants to the, I'm not sure what the right phrase is, but the landowner who's asserting that they've had their value diminished by 20% or more.
Well, I agree that that's the way this functions. But it's nonetheless a new right. It's a new right in Colorado law, recognized, you know, neighboring landowners. I mean, it's a very radical departure from current Colorado law, as articulated by the Colorado Supreme Court. And that radical departure is a different subject by now not only granting rights, I mean, not only grants rights to the landowners who are affected by that regulation. The regulation affects that particular piece of land. Okay? But now everyone surrounding it, of course we have an ambiguity on just what the heck surrounding means, but now everyone surrounding, all of a sudden now they get new rights themselves. This grants a lot more rights, since we're speaking in terms of rights, than simply landowners whose land is affected by land use regulation. It now gives rights to others as well. That's the different subject.
Okay. Well, I would like to hear from the proponents. So, Mr. Carton.
Mr. Gessler, is there any argument that is there an argument? Obviously, you seem very certain that this measure does create this right or rights on behalf.
Since I may be losing this argument, but yes, sir.
Are there arguments that it doesn't, or could an argument be made that the measure doesn't? I guess what I'm saying is, your argument is based on your interpretation of the measure. The text of the measure doesn't say that it creates, as you say, a new property interest for owners of surrounding properties. The text of the measure doesn't say that.
Correct.
And so you're making the argument that that is what this measure does.
Yes.
Could not an argument be made on the other side of that, that it doesn't create a new property interest for owners, or are you? I know where you're coming from, but
yeah.
But
I think one could make that argument, certainly. I guess the way I looked at it is I said, okay, let's assume I want to intervene in a land use regulation enforcement or exemption matter. Do I have standing for intervention? Or let's assume that I wanted to actually file a suit myself. Let's say there has been an exemption, you know, an entity provides an exemption after this notice. Do I have standing to actually file a lawsuit myself? Well, the first question is, you know, is there an injury to a recognized legal interest? And I would look to 2B1, increase the fair market value of any portion of surrounding real properties. I own a surrounding real property. I have a right to prevent that from being, the value from being decreased. I have a cognizable injury under Colorado law. I am a plaintiff. I now have standing. I can go in and litigate this matter. I guess that's the framework I looked at it under, sort of under a standing analysis, you know, Colorado standing analysis. And I assert that I'm confident of my analysis, but you know, I argue that analysis is correct under broad standing under Colorado law, particularly, you know, since it's broader than federal standing. But it creates an injury, and it creates a remedy. And so neighboring landowners have now a right. I guess one could even argue that it goes beyond landowners. Maybe a school district, for example, that claims their taxes are being reduced because that the market value of the neighboring property has been reduced, and therefore they have an injury. I guess it could even go beyond landowners, but it's certainly from the analysis of a neighboring landowner creates a new right, because they have the right to enforce it.
So in, I'm just, this will be my last question here. In your view, the single subject as currently stated is concerning a requirement that public entities provide remedies to owners of privately owned real property for land use regulations that diminish the value of the property. If, in fact, this measure does create a new property interest for owners of surrounding properties, it's your assertion that, utilizing some of the relevant case law here, that that secondary, or what you assert to be a secondary purpose, is disconnected or incongruous with the title as it's reflected in the measure.
That's correct.
One other question, then, as I continue.
I've been answering questions all day, and I'm more than willing to continue.
You know, it's the same subject. I'm pretty comfortable with the inference that 2B, you know, 1 does create standing and therefore rights for the surrounding property owner. At this point, I'm pretty comfortable with that notion, but it seems like that those rights only occur when the property that is surrounded, when that property owner attempts to obtain the exemption. In other words, fundamentally, the measure grants that adversely affected property owner, if the effect is a 20% decline in value, that property owner can seek an exemption. It's only then that there's a right to intervene by the surrounding property owner, I think. There's no independent right granted here, I don't think, for the surrounding property owner to do anything. I don't see any other independent rights unless the burdened property first attempts to get an exemption. Is that correct? Do you think that's correct?
I have to think about that. I'm just sort of looking at the language in item 2 from. It's unusual since I essentially drafted that language. But I have to think about that.
Okay.
I could just have. I mean, I can come up later after the proponents.
Okay. Well, proponents, we're asking a lot of about the meaning of this measure when we should be asking the proponents, probably. So.
Anything, Mr. Dye? Well, I have other questions, but. I don't know if you want to sit down and think about that. I can ask my questions later. I wasn't on the board as part of 86, so remind me what was done on FGH&I. You said those issues came up.
Those were rejected by the board, and they're currently being litigated before the Colorado Supreme Court.
Those same complaints were made on 86?
Yes. My only... The reason I'm including them is that I preserve the argument in the event that the Colorado Supreme Court rules that F through I have merit.
You're conceding these issues on 86?
I am actually representing a different party in this.
All right, let me ask you a question on I. I'm not sure. Well, explain that one to me.
Basically, Colorado statute currently contains a provision that says in civil actions, the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence.
Okay. That's all you need to say. Okay.
Actually, let me argue about the clear and convincing standard for a moment. Independent of number of letter I, I think the clear and convincing standard should be included in this title, not because it represents a departure from current law, but because it is the diametric opposite of initiative number 86. And it represents a departure from number 86, and so it should be included to avoid that confusion. If you look at number 86, basically it says that a public entity has to assert an exception, prove an exception, by clear and convincing evidence. Okay. Number 126 says that the actual substantive right has to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. So the use of clear and convincing evidence sort of flips the burden of proof from the way it's phrased in number 86. So that's really the one that I'm sort of standing on as far as, and including that as part of 2A, as one of the differences between 126 and 86. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. The only other comment I had, I don't know if you want to comment on this, but with regard to your numbers, C, E, well, C and D, I guess, on the title. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead to the title itself here. I think what you make a good point, actually. I find the right paper. It seems to me, rather than saying in the language that was added on last time that we didn't consider until just now, rather referring to serve to protect and protecting commonly held community values or protecting the built or natural environment, that we should really be saying something effective unless said exemption results in a decrease in fair market value, threatens commonly held values, or threatens the built or natural environment. Just throw that out there.
I think that would be more accurate, and that sort of captures my attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gessler.
Thank you.
Mr. Coyne, you'll reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm Will Coyne, and I'm representing the proponents of 126. I guess we can start with the single subject thing, since it's the first issue that Mr. Gessler brought forward. I happen to disagree strongly with Mr. Gessler. I think that his notion that we are creating some new set of rights is really just his own interpretation of one detail of the implementation of this measure. I think there's a very clear one single subject here, and that is that public entities provide remedies to landowners for land use regulations that reduce the value of their property. It's very simple. Single subjects are not violated simply because one detail of implementation is spelled out. It is you know, as long as the procedures specified have the necessary and proper relationship with the substance of the initiative, then they're not a separate subject. And I don't see that here. It is not possible to address the merits of the proposal, interpret the language, or suggest that how it's going to be interpreted by legislatures or local governments. And I think that that's what Mr. Gessler is doing here, is reaching pretty far to figure out how this would be interpreted.
Does that apply to just the single subject issue? Is that, you're limiting your comments to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would start, I think, with that, and then okay, we can move on to the rest
okay
of it.
But
yeah, go ahead then.
Okay. The on the rest of it, I would say that in general, the idea that we are somehow being misleading here, and that this is substantially different from, or that it is not substantially different from Initiative 86, I think is untrue. I think with the language that was included last time, now we've been clear that that was included at the last hearing, we are very clear what the main significant differences are between 126 and 86. Both measures set out criteria for when there will be remedies provided to landowners. And in this title, we've identified the three major times when there will be an exemption. And it's, I think, as clear as day. For us to then sort of pontificate on how big or small those exceptions are, I think that's really a job that the voters should have to decide whether those are big or small. It's, you know, very clear here and almost exactly the language that is put in the actual language of the measure. on what, Mr. Dunn, what you were just talking about changing the language from unless said regulations serve to prevent the decrease, you wanted to change that to what was the language that you'd said? Unless an exemption from would, and then use the specific stuff. I think that's totally fair, and I would concede that so that it does reflect exactly the language that's in the measure, because we certainly are not trying to mislead. So on A, I disagree, and I think that we have been clear about what the main differences are. On B, we just solved B. Okay, on C and D, we have also, I think, just, I've agreed to the changes on those. On E, I think that both for E and for F, when we're talking about one, including how the exemptions will be construed to protect public health, safety, morals, general welfare, and again on including the clear and convincing evidence, I think those are pretty minor points in the grand scheme of what we're talking about here. And I would recommend that we not include those in the title. You know, the average voter is going to know the difference between preponderance evidence and clear and convincing. I think it certainly is a difference, but I don't think it's a major difference. And then, you know, if we're going to include public health, safety, morals, and general welfare and kind of the direction on how to construe all these, I think we'd have to basically include all of the small details in this, which we haven't done here and we haven't done in other initiative 86. And if we're not going to address F, G, and H, then I think that sort of wraps up my summary. I'd be happy to take questions.
Yeah, I'd like a little more discussion on I'm not quite sure how to describe this subject, but how 86 differs from 126 just in general principles, because it seems to me that the addition in 126 of the exceptions in 2B, it appears that it does dramatically change. It's a dramatic difference from what 86, because the exceptions do seem to be pretty broad. So I'd like a little more maybe discussion from you about that. I mean, it does seem, you know, I think what Mr. Gessler was saying that, for example, the exception 2B2, you know, the property may not be exempted from the land use regulation if the exemption would threaten commonly held community values, for example, and or threaten the natural environment. I mean, it strikes me that most land use regulation, in fact, would be based on those kinds of beliefs on the part of the people who adopt those regulations. So that it arguably is very easy to overcome the sort of the rights that the measure purports to exempt or to provide. And, you know, I am wondering to what extent this is like the English language immersion case, where we do need to reflect this is very limited circumstances, if ever, maybe, I'll put that a little more strongly, that a landowner whose property is being maybe diminished by 20% or more would actually be able to obtain an exemption. Can you help me out with that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can tell you that I think that the motivations and the ideas behind both of these measures, 86 and 126, are fairly similar. That there are certain instances out there where there are land use regulations that negatively impact one person, and it's not fair. And that there should be some mechanism for those things to be removed. The difference between the two is on exactly when those things should be remedied. And so, you know, the details of implementation are slightly different. I think in the title here, we've clearly spelled out what those differences are. And I fundamentally disagree with the idea that these are impossible standards to ever be met. I think there are a number of circumstances where someone could come forward and make the case that they've been unduly harmed by a land use regulation, there should be remedies, and that they would meet these standards. You know, and bottom line, I think that the way that we've described what those exemptions are, they are clear enough to the voter that they would be able to decide whether or not those are appropriate instances for a remedy or possibility of a remedy to happen. So we could get, you know, I'd be happy, if you really want to get into a debate about what are all the possible instances where this could happen, but I think that we're then getting into a debate about sort of the merits of the measure, you know, and I don't necessarily know if that's exactly what we should be doing today.
Can I follow up on that,
Mr. Dunn?
It's sort of a broader question to our role, but I mean, when do we cross the line from doing what was required in English only and enter the realm of speculating about the implications of a measure?
Well, you know, I think that this is sort of a unique situation because in English only or English immersion, there weren't any competing measures, and I think what the court was saying was that because the waiver provisions were so detailed that just listing the different aspects or criteria within the waiver provisions was in itself misleading. I think the issue that you face here that was not faced in English immersion was that there is a competing measure, if you will, in number 86. And so we have to also figure out a way to distinguish this measure from number 86.
Yeah, I'm not sure that answers my question. In English immersion, if that's the proper name of it, as I remember, there's a quote statement that the Supreme Court made that the practical effect of the measure is to make bilingual education all but impossible or something like that, and that should be reflected in the title. Not so much just that a laundry list of waiver provisions mask the fact that that's the effect, but you got to state that because voters need to be educated about what the practical implication is. So what I'm trying to figure out if this is such a scenario or not. And when do we go from sort of something on its face having a practical effect like that, and when do we cross into impermissible speculation about what the ramifications of a measure might be?
You know, I think what the court was saying in English immersion was that you have a number of alternatives in terms of how you convey the message. If the listing of the various components is not sufficient to convey the message, then you have to come up with language different from the language in the measure. In this case, what I was trying to bring out, though, is that we have to consider that we do have a competing measure out there, which then adds another factor to how we frame this particular issue.
Well, certainly if we concluded that this measure, the practical effect of this measure was to make payment of compensation for a land use regulation almost impossible to obtain, if we concluded that on its face was the effect, and we drafted the title to say that, certainly that would provide a clear distinction from 86.
And I think the one factor you have to look at is, does the listing of the various exceptions convey that conclusion?
Mr. Carton?
Just a comment. It seems to me that perhaps one thing, one avenue the board could pursue may be short of kind of the arriving at the conclusion interpretation for title purposes that the board did at the Supreme Court's direction in the English immersion case, is I think that
what we probably can conclude is that the remedies or this requirement, the 20% requirement, is subject to, and this may be going too far too, some broadly stated exceptions that are administered by the public entity. And I don't know if that conveys the message that that, in fact, is the direction the board wants to go, if that conveys the message that the requirement may be subsumed by the exceptions. But, for example, I was playing with, I'll just say this and move on, but in the single subject line, maybe saying up front, on line 3, for example, after diminish the value of the property, saying something to the effect there, to distinguish, again, with the idea of distinguishing this measure, both encompassing kind of the 2B and distinguishing this measure from 86, stating there, unless exempted from the requirement by certain broadly stated exceptions that are administered by the public entity. That was my best shot for openers right now. I'm not sure. That may be.
Could you repeat that?
Yes. On line 3, the gist of it would be to signal up front in the statement of the single subject the exceptions in the measure by saying after the value of the property, unless exempted from the requirement, going back to the first line, a requirement that public entities, unless exempted from the requirement by certain broadly stated exceptions that are administered by the public entity. And I don't know if that gets...
Could I offer something? I think the decision you're trying to make right now clearly is are the exceptions in this measure so broad that you need to make some separate statement, some value judgment by the title board about what the level of those exemptions are. And I would again argue that I don't think that you need to, because I disagree about the bigness or smallness of those things. I think that we're very clear here in letting the voters know what those exceptions are. And I guess I think the decision you should first make would be, is there such a compelling reason that we need to make a separate statement here about the power of these exemptions or not? If so, then you could go on to decide, well, then because they're such powerful exemptions, then we should weight them and put them at the top. But I don't think that power is there. I think that it's very evident here what the exemptions are, that there's no need to make a value judgment about the exemptions, and that by putting these exemptions you're talking about up front, then you're kind of defining the measure by the exemptions as opposed to the meat of the measure, which is providing remedies, which is the single subject, and that any voter who reads through the whole six lines, which it's, you know, there some amount of duty by each individual voter to read these things through, they'll read these six lines and be able to see this is clearly a different thing than measure 86.
One other variation on this I'll just throw out that, I mean, I'm thinking about as well, as since we already have the unless language at the end, I mean, I think need to do something more at the beginning to distinguish the measures, but maybe a shorter version, perhaps to as an alternative to Mr. Carton's suggestion, is just to insert in limited circumstances or something like that at the very beginning. Perhaps insert it near the end of line 1. An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a requirement that in limited circumstances public entities provide remedies, etc. So that you see it not as an exception where people may not read that far, more like the fine print when you get to the exceptions, in my opinion, it's difficult for people to see the differences when they're comparing them on the ballot, and they sure start off stating the same basic principle, but to me there are dramatic differences between these. So I don't know, that something along those lines would be a shorter version as well, if we were to modify the expression of the single subject. Does that, I don't know whether that's any better for you, but...
Where are you saying putting in limited circumstances?
Well, probably go several places, but a requirement that in, right after the word that in line one, in limited circumstances.
What if, just as an alternative, if in line four, three and four, where we say in certain circumstances already, if we change certain to limited?
Well, I actually was thinking about saying it both places, and maybe even saying in very limited circumstances or something like that.
I would not be comfortable with that because I don't think it's very limited. It's certainly more limited than 86, but not significant.
I mean, where we have already said in certain circumstances, that is kind of the in the trailers, that's the elaboration on the single subject. So I do tend to agree that certain circumstances is probably not strong enough in my view. It should probably say limited circumstances, but I would probably still propose that we say it both places. But
yeah, I could probably live with that.
Mr. Gessler, if we...
Let me answer your question you earlier made.
Sure. Okay.
You had asked that does the ability of a landowner to enforce this matter create an independent right? And I think sort of carefully analyzing Section 2, the main part of Section 2, the answer is yes. As 86 is structured, it's sort of a dispute, or the two parties to that are the public entity on one hand and the landowner that is affected by the land use regulations on the other hand. What number 126 does with that provision as far as the neighboring landowners is it sort of releases the provision from the moorings of a two-way dispute and turns it into a three-way dispute. And in fact, if you look at number 2, it allows public entities to do one of two things, to either exempt a landowner or provide just compensation to that landowner. I could see an instance here where the public entity makes a decision to, for example, exempt a landowner or even provide just compensation to an owner. And someone turns around and says, no, you still can't do that because you've hit the 20% threshold. And in fact, let's say a public entity enacts a regulation, it hits the 20% threshold, okay, and then that public entity decides to grant a special use permit or exempt them in some other format through a land exchange swap or something along those lines. Well, that exemption could be prohibited. I mean, because once you hit the 20% threshold, then the neighboring landowner's rights spring into existence, regardless of what the public entity may want to do in this proceeding with respect to these particular land use regulations, even if, I think it's a valid argument, even if it's, for example, a special use permit or something, an exemption that would normally be allowed by other regulations, but it's a discretionary adjudicatory type thing. So, I mean, it seems as though it does create the, sort of those independent rights by neighboring landowners, and experience that as interveners, you always like wreaking havoc upon the efforts of the two parties to structure their dispute because you have rights that you want to assert, regardless of what those other parties may do. So regardless of what the public entity does and the landowner who is affected does, this neighboring landowner is going to have rights. And so, Mr. Carton, when you had said, and I guess what sort of helped formulate that is when you talked about a potential single subject, land use regulations administered by a public entity or enforced by a public entity, this actually brings a third party into the mix. it includes neighboring landowners too. So I'm happy to answer questions on that, but I don't mean to belabor that point.
Thank you. Mr. Coyne, did you have anything further? I'm not sure. I may have interrupted you, but is there anything else you wanted to tell the board in response to the motion for rehearing?
No, I think mostly folks are conversation subjects, so once we get through that, then...
Well, I think you probably ought to go ahead and address your other responses as well. I mean... Because unlike when we initially set the titles, I wasn't planning to take that as a separate vote. I mean, unless the board members want to. I mean, if there's some feeling on the part of the board that there is a single subject problem, okay, then I think this is a good time to stop, and because that would make the rest of it moot. But I'm not convinced there's a single subject problem personally.
Okay. Nor am I.
Okay.
Just give me a quick second to review here what we've gone through. And
okay.
I guess all I would sort of say in conclusion is that I think that we've made a couple of changes that have addressed Mr. Gessler's concerns. I think that... with adding in, I've thought about it more, and I think adding in the language that Mr. Hobbs suggested in terms of just clarifying that this is a little more limited than Initiative 86, and then having language at the end there that lists the three major differences, I'm comfortable that I think this is significantly different and would argue that the rest of the things that Mr. Gessler had asked for, including talking about the changing the legal threshold and the... how to construe the specific exemptions, that all of those are kind of minor. So that's all.
Okay. Thank you. Discussion by the board? Mr. Carden.
Mr. Chairman, consistent with your comments and the discussion here, I would support inserting on line one after the word that, limited circumstances, and then I believe it was also the discussion that on line four, instead of certain circumstances, it would be in limited circumstances instead of in certain, so strike certain and insert limited.
I would support that. And for discussion, I'll go ahead and make that motion.
I'll second.
Seconded. Any discussion?
Sorry. I'm just trying to think about it from the perspective of the voter in the ballot box and looking at this one in 86. And if I'm reading this and I'm a pro-just compensation voter, and I read this and I think, that seems like a good idea, to provide, in limited circumstances, compensation where land use regulation reduces the value of property. And so I view this as a pro-just compensation measure. And then I read 86 and sort of reads the same way, if it doesn't say limited. And I think we're getting closer, but I'm not sure what the answer is, but it seems to me there's still sort of read, maybe not verbatim similarly, but from a practical standpoint, as a voter reading them, they get the same effect when they read them. And I'm not sure if 126 is actually, if that's actually what it is, as sort of has been expressed by at least some of the board. But I don't know.
Well, my intent or my thought here is that I think this proposal is a middle-of-the-road approach. And that is, I mean, I think a stronger approach would be more like the English immersion case, where we do something along the lines that just affirmatively states that the exemptions or the rights afforded the landowner to either compensation or exemption are very difficult to get. I mean, that would be the English. I mean, expressing that conclusion would be consistent, perhaps, with the English immersion case. And I'm a little uncomfortable with that. And there may be a better way to do this, but when I compare the measures, they both do grant rights to landowners to either compensation or exemption from land use regulations. The devil is in the exemption. I mean, over the exceptions. And the exception seems so much broader, as Mr. Carton said, in number 126, that the rights granted to the landowner are probably more limited. And, you know, if they, you know, I can accept that they both grant some rights to compensation or exemption from land use regulation, but just simply trying to distinguish them up front so that at least somebody comparing the two ballot titles, say, in the voting booth, can see that one is more limited than the other. They both do grant these sort of rights or prohibit or provide the remedies. So I don't know. I don't have a better approach, but to me that's a fairly modest way to recognize the difference between 86 and 126. But coupled with the exceptions that we've expressed at the end, and which perhaps do need to be fixed up a bit, but
it's almost as if, I mean, maybe this is going too far, but it's almost as if what the measure really does is a prohibition on just compensation except in rare circumstances. So the proponent wouldn't agree with that. But.
No, that would be a statement for
the I mean, that may be a little strong, but my gut tells me that's the practical effect.
Would it help if we move the phrase in limited circumstances down to follow the word remedies? So they would read concerning a requirement that public entities provide remedies in limited circumstances.
Does that help? Say that again. You put it where?
So that it would read concerning a requirement that public entities provide remedies in limited circumstances to owners of privately owned real property. If you're concerned that the way it's being proposed right now is that it limits, that it's all about the limitations now. I was trying to find a way to address that concern, but I'm not sure that improves things. But
I actually think that's a good suggestion. Putting it after remedies, is that what you said?
Yeah. Mr. Carton, what do you think?
I think that may move in the direction of Mr. Dunn's concern.
Let's move that, Ms. Gomez. I mean, the downside is that I like signaling it right up front, but in some ways I do think moving it to follow remedies is a little better reading of or a better expression of what I'm trying to achieve. So after. Remedies in limited circumstances. Is that any better, Mr. Dunn, or I don't know?
I think it's marginally better. I think the concern is still there that it sounds like a pro-compensation measure. But
was there a motion on that? I think there was a motion, but I'm not sure. There was. So we'll just consider that a a change to the motion.
And the motion is just on lines 2 and 4?
That's correct.
If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Mr. Dunn, I think you had some good ideas about revising the language at the end of the measure,
sure.
Or the end of the titles, if you want to address that.
Sure. I think just for discussion's sake here, at least, after you have comma unless said and insert exemptions result in a... An exemption may need to be singular, I'm not sure, but we'll come back to that. Result in, I'm not sure yet actually, but A, and then delete all the way to decrease. Yeah, I think it should be singular exemption. And the results. And then after the next comma, delete, protect, and insert threatens. Same in the last clause. Threatens, plural. Plurals on there. That's right, threatens. Threatens, sorry, ENS. And same thing on the last line. No, instead of protect or threatens. That makes sense?
Just so we're sure that that's what the measure says. The language of the measure says this subsection 2, the 20% requirement, shall not apply to any portion of privately owned real property that, if exempted from said land use regulation, would decrease or threaten. What your suggestion is, it's kind of tying on to the exempt the owner in line 4. Unless said exemption.
Yeah, because previously it said unless said land use regulation serves, but it's really unless the exemption results in a decrease in market value, threatens community values, or alter natural environment.
Okay.
Is that right?
Is that your motion?
That is my motion.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other suggested changes to the titles in response to the motion for rehearing?
I would just say that I think I echo, I would echo Mr. Dunn's concern over whether or not the language in limited circumstances goes far enough in light of some of the case law, and given the text of this measure. But I think we've deliberated on this fairly extensively, and I think it is.
The only other suggestion I might have is to insert only. I'm not sure if it's proper grammar, but in front of in, only in limited circumstances. I don't know if I'm making that suggestion, but I don't know if that helps any.
I'm not too crazy about it personally. It seems a little awkward. I mean,
it does.
And I'm not sure is it as accurate. I'd almost rather say in very limited circumstances, but I'm still reluctant to go too far with this.
And I guess in final comment, in light of Mr. Gessler's objection, going back to the specific objection that the title and submission clause are misleadingly similar to the title and submission clause in 050686. In order to meaningfully inform the voters, the title and submission clause must explain the differences between this initiative and 86. I think these changes do, although there may be in some folks' eyes subtle, I think they do address both the statutory requirement that Mr. Kneiser elaborated on our last meeting and do address 2A. Of Mr. Gessler's objection. Motion for a hearing.
Well, if there are no other suggestions, then I'd entertain a motion to deny the motion for a hearing, except to the extent that the board has made changes to the titles. And again, for the record, the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. Maybe before we, if there is such a motion, before we do that, I'll probably read into the record what I think how the title would read based on what we've done so far.
I'll make that motion.
Mr. Dunn moves that the board reject the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has made changes to the titles. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. And let me just read into the record how the title would read, and with the understanding that ballot title submission clause would be the same, except in the form of a question. The title would read, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a requirement that public entities provide remedies in limited circumstances to owners of privately owned real property for land use regulations that diminish the value of the property, comma, and, comma, in connection therewith, comma, requiring public entities in limited circumstances to compensate an owner or exempt the owner from the land use regulations if a public entity enacts land use regulations that reduce the value of any portion of the property by 20% or more, comma, unless said exemption results in a decrease in fair market value of any portion of surrounding real properties, comma, threatens commonly held community values, comma, or threatens the built or natural environment. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0, and that concludes action on number 126. The time is 5:14 p.m. I think that concludes our agenda.
For the year.
For the year. For the season. We're adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you.